Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X mobile studio in the Valley of the Sun. It's time for Tech of the Town, your place for entrepreneurial stories and lessons from the Valley's most inspiring technology leaders.
Welcome to Tech of the Town here on Business Radio X, where we tell stories that the traditional tech media tends to ignore and help connect you to the right people. I'm your host, Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and I'm joined in the studio by David McKenna, SVP for R&D at Axway. Welcome, David.
Thank you, Adrian.
And Patrick Gilbert from Compendia. Welcome, Patrick.
Thank you.
So glad you both are here. We're going to have a very interesting conversation about your companies, about your background, and about your outlook on technology and innovation here in the Valley. David, let's start with you. Axway works with more than 11,000 organizations in over 100 countries relying on your products and services. You are a data integration company. Talk to us about what that means and what kind of services you're providing these folks.
Yeah, so Axway has a multi-country footprint, and our product line is called Amplify. And Amplify provides integration to various different protocols, various different consumers. And as such, as the technology stack in the world evolves over time, Axway's platform has evolved to meet different needs, from API integration to file-based integration to more classic EDI-based integration. So that our product and platform and our offering continues to evolve to meet the market needs.
This is one of the things that those outside of the narrow specialization might not understand the full implications of, because when you talk about connecting all of the different parts of tech stack, for example, you're dealing with so many different issues. It's not just data, it's security, it's all the other things that come along with it. So what are some of the central problems that Amplify solves for users?
Well, the world today is connected. Every device is connected, every machine is connected. Every machine is different. Every piece of software is different and comes from a different time period. And as a result of that, protocols are different. And as a result of that, for the interconnectivity, there's a need for security, as you said, governance. There's a need for visibility and for what is happening within those connections. And that's where Axway play a role, to provide that governance layer, that visibility, so that things can be connected, particularly within the enterprise, where there could be in banking, where every transaction, every connection has a monetary value.
Yes, absolutely. And the security of the data can have a significant cost when breaches happen, as we sometimes see in the news. Certainly the consumer-facing view of all of this is usually only in the breach. Mm-hmm. But the awareness of the work being done to provide the fundamental layers that make it work better and well is very important. And it strikes me as interesting, again, as something of an outsider to this particular niche, that it seems like when it's working well, it's invisible.
So I wrote a blog recently themed around Halloween, which is obviously next week, called Fear-Driven Development. And in that, I'm talking about the fears of what a modern software developer has. And one of the things is about a fear of being hacked. So today, it's possible that the code that you write today may appear as a CVE, a vulnerability online. It may even appear on CNN, which is far worse, where you've got things like where modern vulnerabilities are getting branded. So you've got the likes of Heartbleed, which then obviously becomes mainstream, whereas previously things just weren't known. And then far worse is then there's a liability to the company, there's a liability to CEOs, CIOs, people are losing their jobs. So it all becomes not only that the individual's information has been compromised, now all of a sudden there's people who are responsible for the delivery of that, who may be very far away from the code base, but they are at risk. So then what that now means is that there's a lot more emphasis on secure software delivery, so that there's certain gates put in place, and we've got these gates in our software delivery pipeline where that to make sure that the code, you know, has been statically analyzed, there's pen testing run against it, there's vulnerability scans, all this before it gets to production, where then when it's in production, it's locked down, secured, and continuously monitored.
You mentioned that there are equipment from different eras that are being connected. And this brings up a whole set of issues, I'm sure, because when in the API world, for example, to make things talk to each other that are not just generations apart, but perhaps worlds apart is a big challenge. Can you, especially the enterprise level where you've got layers of sediment developed over time, you know?
So if you're a paleontologist in there and you're digging down through the layers, there's a lot of skeletons there and you know, a lot of fossils that can be dug up. However, there is value in those fossils and they need to be leveraged and used in different ways, like bought to the mobile market, which may, like some information may be like used internally that needs to be bought externally. So where APIs play a role is they can be a facade over these layers. So that means then externally to your mobile app or maybe to a web app, then you're utilizing information that you have today in different ways. So APIs help in a sort of modernization of infrastructure. But it's a modernization where the facade externally has changed. Internally, you still have those skeletons are still there. And they're still working away quite well because it's too difficult to lift and shift them either to cloud or to re-implement it. Too difficult, too big a risk, and too costly. So with APIs, you can leverage what you have without having to get the cost of changing what you have.
You know, it's fascinating to reach outside of technology for a minute with another metaphor. It reminds me of the nature of language itself, where innovation over time in the vocabulary and usage of words, and you end up with a situation where you have a very dynamic and flexible system that contains within it persisting elements from earlier expressions of that language. English is a fascinating example where there's an early Anglo-Saxon code base, if you will, that's baked in. And of course, then 50% of the English vocabulary is French due to the Norman invasion and other things. And English has now become a global language where we're communicating in SMS and on Snapchat and TikTok and using emojis and
emojis and symbols come back in. It's full circle.
Right? So the return of cave art and hieroglyphs and petroglyphs it's all there. And this is one of the things that fascinates me as only a mid-level user of technology rather than a developer or systems architect or something, is that at some level, all of this has to interface with humans and has to help them accomplish their goals, manage their workflow, enable their business processes, and really enable the commercial viability of their enterprise. How did you as a human being find yourself into this world? Take us back a bit and tell us the story of young David and how you got into the role that you're in now.
Okay. So I started coding when I was 10 or maybe 8 on an Amstrad 464. And I was doing computer games, and it started that you'd buy a magazine, a monthly magazine, and you literally copy the code.
You type it in from the back.
Yeah.
I was there, man.
Exactly.
Was this in BASIC or what was it?
It was BASIC, yeah. Yeah. And so that's where I started. And then it happened, so you might tell from my accent, I'm Irish. Yes. So I actually only came to the Valley 2 years ago as part of it. Actually asked me to relocate to bring some innovation to the R&D center here. So when I was 10, I was coding then. And then at school, when I was 15, they actually introduced a computer science course. And we actually did an exam called the GCSE, which is an English exam, but it was in computer. And I did very well in that. And at that point, fell in love, did computer science in college, got a degree in that, and then started at a small Irish startup doing telco network management. And then ever since then, I've been very close to the code base all the time. And I joined a company called Vordell in 2000. So Vordell was a long-lived startup. We were running for around 10 years or so. And then we got acquired by Axway. And so with Vordell, we had an XML firewall originally, which is basically securing XML traffic. We evolved that to, if you remember SOA with SOAP days, we evolved our XML system to SOA. And then with the advent of APIs, then we also then added a layer on top for API management. So it's the same principles around governance and visibility and security, speed and performance, sitting at the edge of an enterprise has always been there with the work we're doing in Vordell. And we evolved and adapted it as technology was changing. So we were keeping pace with that.
I'm interested in the way in which the Irish context itself has shaped some of the work you're doing now. I mean, I'm not as deeply familiar with this as I would like to be, but I'm aware that in the mid-90s, it was a fast-growing ecosystem and a large number of experts and companies have emerged from.
Yeah, so the Irish government has made significant efforts to invest in IT. It's seen, and particularly that Ireland has a huge advantage. Back to language, we speak English, although quite fast, maybe not very well. We do speak English, and for Europe, that's convenient, particularly for, with North America. So it's that there, and also tax incentives, whether that's tax breaks for innovation for startups or to attract large multinationals like the Googles, Facebook, LinkedIn. They're all present in Ireland. And then even historically, they're the more, let's say, the more internet companies, the Microsoft, Oracle, IBM are also there. So again, it's like the layers of the enterprise. There's also layers of companies who have now have their European HQ in Ireland. That, as each decade, we say, the successful companies have based there so that they're getting the benefit of the tax breaks, the local population, which is highly skilled, and also that the fact that they speak English.
Yeah. I mean, let's have you compare a little bit that experience with what you're finding here in the Valley. You moved here to Arizona 2 years ago, you said. What's your overview level opinion? I recognize opinions are personal, about kind of the scene, as it were, the technology and innovation scene here.
There's similarities and dissimilarities. So that, like, there is a scene here. It's obviously a lot smaller. The influence of the large vendors isn't here. There are some, but there are a lot of like startups here, almost like the equivalent number that you'd see like per capita in Dublin. So that it is here. There's as is US, there's a lot more focus here on meetups and stuff, which are, they happen in Dublin, but they're only a recent thing that's happened, maybe more popular in the last 3 years or so. So you can certainly see more of that here when Galvanize and things like that. You can see that it's much more vocal and animated a community here.
Now, again, we're straying away from the core theme here, but would you say that's because there's less of an organic social scene? In other words, it's not that there aren't meetups in Dublin, it's just that they're not meetups. It's you're at the pub, you're at wherever you are. There's definitely environments where you're interacting with people.
Yeah.
In the absence of that kind of social layer, especially in a very dispersed geographical area like the Valley.
Yeah, that's one disadvantage, is the geographic disbursement. So like where the Axway office is based in Dublin, like, you know, I can walk like 100 meters, I'm at Facebook. You know, I could walk 100 meters south, I'm at LinkedIn. Go the other direction, I'm in IBM. So, and then, so it's all quite central. And also like, as it's located so near to each other, then yeah, you have the more ad hoc meetups where whatever environment that is, whether that's, you know, at lunch or whether it's like, yes, having a drink after hours. Yes, those conversations do happen. And then it's a lot smaller community, or a lot tighter community.
Well, and geographically smaller,
mm-hmm.
For sure. Now, you mentioned APIs, and you recently wrote an article called "API is Dead, Long Live the APIs." What's that about? What's the core theme of that publication?
Oh, that was a kind of opinion piece. So
yeah.
It was talking about that the REST APIs, which today are the incumbent, they're the most popular type of API. REST APIs, yes, they're still growing, but their market share is dropping. Okay, so you're seeing more and more different types of APIs, and the different types of API depends on the needs of the consumer. So for example, there's GraphQL, which is created by Facebook. What GraphQL solves is for a mobile application, so the mobile application doesn't need to call back to the API many times. You can make one call and get a response to the mobile app required. Then you have internally where there's an explosion of microservices, because obviously with the whole digital transformation, the people want to try and move fast. So they're adopting things like Conway's Law for their organization to change into small self-empowered teams that they're building these services. But in between the services internally, that then they'll be talking gRPC from Google, which is a serialization protocol. But again, it's still an API, but the format is different. So you see, yes, APIs, REST APIs are still growing, but their market share is reducing because there are other APIs coming to play which are better suited to the different types of client needs. So it's from now it's the client application that controls what the server should be doing. So the clients are dictating, hey, server, please use gRPC or whatever protocol suits them. If it's IoT, it might be MQTT that is used. So it's all the client. So it's now become a democracy. So the clients are voting really for what the need is for the server side.
Right. Well, it's in a way a democracy or at least a marketplace where the demand is coming from the application reaching back to the core infrastructure. Let's talk a little bit about the R&D role and the way in which on one hand, you have to shepherd the integrity and continuity of the established solution set. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you have to push the edges and stay ahead of the curve, as it were, find new ways of solving problems or maybe even coming up with forecasting problems that haven't yet emerged and trying to get ahead of them. Mm-hmm. Is that something that comes naturally to you? Is that the way your mind works? What makes you good in that role and how does it play out within your organization? Obviously, you don't do it alone. How does it all get done?
Yeah, so there's a personal side and there's how the organization or the system works. So what you're seeing now and what we're doing in Axway is you see that there's in order to execute on anything, then we have the agile process. But before that, in order to assess whether an idea, hypothesis is any good or worth value to the market, then we have design thinking. And then we would enter into more of a lean UX, lean user experience to identify things like the persona, user journey, et cetera, before we go into execution. And execution would be coding. So what's very interesting, what's happening today for a developer, that some things are shifting left, which is like, for example, adoption of DevOps, because today we produce cloud services. In the past, it would have been software that was shipped on CD, installed, people may upgrade once a year, once every 6 months. Now it's in the cloud. It's continuous deployment. And with DevOps, then developers and operators are working hand in hand. So now the developers are responsible for the uptime of the service. So if you build it, you keep it alive. Okay, you build it, you run it. So that has shifted left. But then there's things that have shifted further right. So if you write code, that's expensive. So a weird thing is I've often said is stop writing code.
Uh-huh. So instead turn to libraries and modules and
No. That's still writing code. You adopt that library, you're responsible for it. You're responsible for the security of it. You're responsible for all these things. So it's more that rather than rush into writing code, is that, step back, see what the market actually needs. Let's not waste time writing some code that may never be used. Make an assessment, see whether whether our hypothesis will be proven out. Get some metrics, get some data. And then we'll write some code and we'll execute on it. So this is what I say. So some things are shifting right and other things are shifting left. So the role of a developer has changed quite dramatically in the last 10 years because of this. So one is they have to prove theories with their data before they go in towards execution. That's working with product management, product owners, with a UX team. And then on the other hand, a lot of additional work has gone left in terms of like the security, in terms of the operations, even documentation, that developers are responsible for writing documentation for the solution.
So it sounds like you're painting a picture that is multidisciplinary, that requires knowledge of ways of working. You mentioned agile, you mentioned design thinking and kind of the lean, testing. And also in the same realm, I suppose, the kind of customer development and product management related perspectives of making sure that even validating the use case and that this really solves a problem someone's going to mm-hmm. need enough to pay for it. How does that multifaceted training happen? It used to be that somebody who was passionate about coding could devote themselves to that skill and then find themselves in a role. How's it play out now in the professional career?
Yeah, so that notion of a software developer who's dedicated to coding, I think, is a thing of the past. And then what you see, as I mentioned before, with Conway's Law, you've got small, discrete teams who have a multifunctional and responsibility for the delivery of the service. Within that team, there is a product owner. The product owner works with product management to understand the needs of the user, understands the needs of the market. And as a result of that, the team is exposed to all of it. So a lot of that may happen organically, but the key thing is to know what the process is and then more importantly, what the practice is. For example, like if you go back just to even Agile, Agile is quite simple. You know, epics, user stories, deliver, assess, and repeat. However, the practice can be quite challenging. And then that's where a lot of people struggle. And that's why there's Agile coaches in order to help with the practice. So theory is easy. You know, you can pick up the theory on design thinking, lean UX and Agile. You could do all that in an evening. But then it's actually when you take that theory and then you apply it as the practice is where things get more challenging.
Now, as someone, a technologist who's evolved along with the trends into an executive, manager, leader, really architecting the work of teams, not just tech, what have been some of your challenges along the way? What have been some of those moments of real growth for you that have propelled you as you solved for whatever into the role that you're in now?
Well, leaving the code, I'd always say, was the challenging thing. So, and I still do code at times. I participate in hackathons that we have within Axway. That was a challenge to get away from it, to trust people, to empower people, to let people become subject matter experts and to allow them to thrive and to learn. That was challenging. But within Axway, I've kind of also been quite lucky in that I've had many different roles. So I for our post-acquisition, then I was asked to be global architect. And as a result of that, I was able to see a lot of the direction of where Axway want to go. I was able to interact with a lot of Axway's customers and then interact with the various different product lines that we do have. Because Axway has R&D centers in Sofia in Bulgaria, in Bucharest, Romania, in Paris, in Dublin, in Phoenix and in Santa Clara, but I was able to interact with all these different R&D teams who are all producing different services, different types of products. Some of them themselves are more legacy products that are installed on-premise. Others are cloud-based multi-tenant services. So that gave me a very good perspective and horizon of the whole integration space. And then when I relocated to Phoenix 2 years ago, then I was asked, could I manage the API project again from an R&D perspective, so that to help deliver more innovation and to deliver a cloud-based service for API, which is Amplify Central.
Yeah. This must also put you in regular dialogue with other enterprise architects, CIOs, security professionals. I mean, the very nature of your products requires you to interface with the other human professionals in your client companies and in others as well. What are some of the common themes in these conversations? Where are things going? What are the areas of concern? At a high level,
obviously Axway is a larger organization, so I'm not in that many conversations, but they do happen. And there's a huge concern on the cloud because if today's companies operate largely responsible for their own data center, for their own infrastructure, their own applications. Now what you're seeing everyone wants to move fast. You know, everyone's afraid of disruptors. They want to adopt the latest technology, whether, you know, containerization, cloud, continuous deployment, DevOps. That's where they all want to be so that they too can be disruptors on the market, even though today they're incumbents. So this week, I think the CEO of Bank of America made a statement that they built their own cloud, and as a result of that, they saved $2 billion. Okay? So there's a movement. Everyone wants to go there. But the fact that they built their own cloud means that they don't want to be running on Microsoft Azure, AWS, or Google. They need to have control. And we see that in a lot of enterprises is that we're an insurance company. We cannot possibly let our data leave the boundaries of this organization and be in the cloud. We don't trust the cloud. So they want to have the advantages of the cloud, but there's a trust issue between it's our data, it's not going there. How do we govern that?
How much of that is, this is a maybe off the wall left field question, how much of that is tied to some strange notions of sovereignty in a sort of 20th century nation state kind of world? In other words, the cloud is very, if I were as an anthropologist, political scientist, historian, to come up with a metaphor for this, seem to be doing metaphors today. I would think that, you know, the traditional way of doing it is very much nation states with borders, kind of a, you know, post-World War II UN kind of idea, which has got its own issues, let's be clear. But as opposed to a globalist view in which, you know, there's flexibility, there's non-state actors, et cetera, et cetera.
Same problems exist.
Yes.
The same political boundaries, possibly political boundaries related to geographic boundaries, exist in the cloud. Data sovereignty is a key point. And so, for example, like that's why we are offering our platform in Europe, our platform in the US, so that we can adhere to the local, let's say, regionalization rules, so that like personal information doesn't leave Europe and come to the US, so that it stays local to where the people are, our customers and consumers are. So it's a key need and a key ask for any cloud service. And that's why you see the likes of Amazon is that they have an explosion in the number of regions they're supporting. It's largely to meet speed and to be local, yes, but also to meet with the data sovereignty rules that happen to be local. And the data sovereignty rules are complex. Like even within Germany, there's data sovereignty rules for particular councils. So a small region within Germany has their own rules, which are slightly different to the national rules of Germany. So it's a complex mess, but it's as complex as why you need the likes of the UN there to govern it.
That would actually work better. But yes, still to solve the same problem, which is a community of different actors with hopefully aligned around some common goals.
But that's another trust thing with, you know, with
right.
Particularly what's happened with Facebook recently, and like, you know, was it Cambridge Analytics, Analytica, like what happened there is like, so you go like, okay, so you have my data and you sold it to who and for what reason? So everyone will need to know where their data is and what use it is.
And those boundaries did not work either.
Yeah.
Right. And this brings us to, I think, you know, there's a key difference between the enterprise level of dealing with these challenges and then, of course, the consumer-facing side of it. I saw a very funny post the other day where someone said, can I just accept all cookies everywhere and get back to using the internet, please? Because, you know, now with GDPR and everything else, we've had...
When GDPR rules came in, were you not spammed? But how many emails did you get for all these services you'd signed up years ago? And didn't realize that.
Right. Well, and which raises this question both for enterprise clients as well as for small business owners and as well as for general, you know, users in the consumer world. There's a level of responsibility and awareness that ought to be required of digital citizenship and participation in this ecosystem. After Cambridge Analytica, to use that great example, just going through and realizing what apps have I authorized? Yeah. It's available for me to do my own little mini audit of that.
Or do they care? This is comes back to the post you talk about. Do they care?
I'm
getting value from sharing my photographs or talking to my family who are remote, and that the value I'm getting from the app far exceeds my concern of the personal information.
Right.
But that's the individual.
The stakes are very, exactly.
The stakes are very at the individual level. But then when you roll it up and it's like all of a sudden the data is huge, it's big data. You now have like, you have a subscriber base of let's say hundreds of millions. And from that information, you can then infer a lot of other data. So it's when it scales is when the problems occur. It's not really at the individual level, and individuals won't necessarily think of that. They'll just think about the value they're getting from the service.
The term that's often bandied about these days is digital transformation. In the context of Axway, what is the significance of this, and what are you doing about it?
We're doing a number of things. This is back to fear. Everyone's afraid. Digital transformation, first of all, is not about technology. It's about the business. It's about a business who's going to embrace technology in order to be successful, in order for them either to be disruptors, in order for them to either find new markets, in order for them to stay competitive, in order for them to speed up. So it's a business need. And then how that maps to technology, then that's the technology I mentioned earlier, like cloud, containers, microservices, DevOps. Well, there's technology, DevOps is more of a culture. So there's a culture side with DevOps, and then also then adoption of different processes, which then that goes back to design thinking, lean UX or lean enterprise and agile then in terms of the execution and delivery on those ideas. So everyone's changing. So that's what digital transformation is about. But it must be aligned with a business goal, because adopting technology for technology's sakes is just a waste of time. It's just technology.
You know, that's a very refreshing perspective as we wrap up this dimension, this part of the conversation. The idea that questioning whether or not something is necessary, you know, it's assumed, I think, that R&D means let's just go for it. Let's just make stuff. Let's solve problems. Let's innovate for its own sake. It sounds like a very balanced point of view that you're bringing to your role, which is, well, we need to look at this. It needs to align with business goals. It we can't spend money on developing code we don't need, so let's pause. How much of that is due to kind of a maturity of this technology versus just a balanced perspective on your role?
So I'd tell you this, historically, IT and software in any organization was a cost center. Now, actually, we're different. We've always been a provider of software, but if you're the likes of like a bank or insurance, then you need to have software and you need to have development in place in order to realize business value. Historically, it used to be a cost center. Oh, we need this, but now you actually need it in order to stay relevant, to provide value to the market, as that's a key. So the thing is, if you Uber, yeah, it's a ride sharing app. But however, where their investment is in the technology behind it. So they're a technology company who are serving a market need. The business need is for ride sharing. And it's the same, you can apply it to Amazon, you can apply it to Airbnb. And these are the models that people are looking at, saying that you can be successful on the market with technology. And then for the existing enterprises, is they're realizing this and they say, we have to embrace technology, digital transformation in order to be successful, as opposed to historically where it'd be, this is a cost center. Our main goal is to sell insurance or whatever it may be. Now is that it's utilize technology so we can be more successful.
Yeah. I mean, it's a fascinating time when I think not only are people viewing, let's create our own cloud architecture, let's do our own thing, but realizing that so many different services, so many different products have a technology backbone. It's almost as if the democratization of innovation and tech is kind of reaching out into even boring industries that would not have normally. I mean, just in this studio a few months ago, I was hearing about a hay broker. So farmers, mm-hmm. hay harvesting, there's a whole commodities market for hay, deciding that they needed to hire a developer to produce an AI-driven platform for them to forecast hay prices,
yeah, so predictability, yeah,
and
yeah.
developing a technology layer to 150-year-old farming business. Mm-hmm. So fascinating times. David McKenna, SVP R&D at Axway, thank you very much indeed. Let's turn to Patrick Gilbert, founder and chief innovator with Compendia. Now, you've been listening to this part of the conversation. You must have a lot of thoughts about some of the things David has shared, but let's at least start with some background on you and your own company. Tell us about Compendia. What kind of work do you do and what problems do you solve?
Compendia means a body of knowledge. And what we do is that we use our knowledge of the digital world to help smaller companies, enterprise, in their digital transformation. And we might use tools such as, well, actually, we were talking in the lobby before. We don't currently use Axway, but
<You will then>.
But we use other technology stacks and other type of products.
One or two help. More meetups, and you might have this this deal nailed down.
No, well, actually, we use one of their sub platforms, but before the acquisition, so it was interesting to realize that, but. So we work with a various type of companies, whether a solar company or a digital music company or a producer serving the indie bands that wants to go from, you know, having all artists posting their music independently on YouTube, to have some kind of organization putting some infrastructure so that people have access to services, whether it's to buying tickets, knowing that a certain unknown band to many is available in a certain town and so on. And they look at it and say, we need to have a digital solution. We need a platform. And they don't even know where to start. So that's where we come in. We look at, sit with the customer, look at their needs, produce requirements, and in some cases, actually do the development work, whether using our resources, independent resources, or in the case of other companies that have their resources and they need more guidance, we can use also their own internal development team.
Now, you also have decades of experience and innovation and product development, moving across a lot of industries. And one of the things that always fascinates me about that is it means you've seen so much come and go as things have evolved. I mean, I was fortunate, as we were mentioning before we started the broadcast, that I grew up in my dad's radio station. And so in that way, I was exposed very early to a lot of trends in technology, again, on the adoption side. But, you know, we had, you know, an IBM PC when they first rolled off the line in 81 or whatever, and, doing the programming from the magazines, putting in the basic. I could never get the sprite graphics to work on my Commodore 64, but that's probably because I'm a terrible coder. So you have seen so many trends and you've participated in so many things. Can you, Patrick, walk us through that history in a way? Give us a sense of the different roles you've played that have brought you to this point.
Well, I'm an engineer by training, so, and I'm Canadian, French Canadian, as you mentioned earlier, I'm from Montreal, so that's where I started my career after school, and I worked in a telecommunication consulting company and engineering firm. So had the opportunity to touch many different technologies working for customers. And the two things that really fascinated me were the early days of the internet, packet networks and so on. And wireless technology and the very burgeoning, mobile applications. And, as I was working there, I started working on a project for distribution of information. We were using XML content to distribute nationwide for the government. And we developed technology to transport that data over what were, at the time, analog TV signals. And I thought, maybe there's something there, starting a company just to do that, not only for the government, but for other companies. So we developed technology, hardware, software for Windows at the time. As a small Canadian company, came to present that to the U.S., to a committee that was looking at different ways to do it in conjunction with companies from the U.S. and from Japan and so on, and looking at building a consortium and so on. And we came in and asked them, would you like a demo? And that was a kind of a bit of a pivotal moment. So we had two companies that were interested, very much interested in ours. One was based here in Arizona called Wayfor, and the other one that you might know called Intel.
I've heard of them. They've been around. Yeah.
And as it turned out, we were acquired by Wayfor, and a few months later, with a different hat, different business card, I went and licensed the same technology that we brought in to first Intel, then Microsoft, and so on. And that's what became the backbone of WebTV for Windows. So integration of data into PCs sent over television signals. After that, as I was working there, I started working a little bit more with mobile application, or the early iteration of internet on a phone. And I thought that I wanted to focus on that, bring more information to people's phone, and seeing that this would be their primary way to communicate. And even though, BlackBerry came out, thought it was great idea, but it was expensive and, again, not available to smaller companies because it was too expensive in infrastructure. People needed at the time to have their own. There was no such thing as a central BlackBerry enterprise server. People needed to have their own. It was a major investment in infrastructure. And I guess that's another constant in my life, trying to serve the underserved or the smaller companies that don't have the means, essentially, or the knowledge internally to be able to do that. So started a company called For Smartphone to offer hosted exchange and synchronization services to what was a smartphone at the time, in 2003 or 2004, people didn't know what it was. And started focusing on that and bringing information to small businesses using their mobile devices. And Four Smartphone was made available in like 83 countries. We lived through that, some of those restrictions. So at some point we had to have servers in the EU, which we chose the UK at the time, in order to be able to respect the rules of having the data stored, the EU data stored on the other side of the Atlantic. So that when I was listening to him earlier, and I'm very, very aware of that, even for a small company, and it's a major burden.
But I guess with the cloud today, it's somewhat easier. Now you no longer have to put your
correct.
You don't have to put your servers over there. You can say you can actually click
and move.
Run in this region, please. Uh-huh. So it makes it easier to solve the problem. Oh, the problem still exists.
No, definitely. Yeah. Definitely.
The evolution of mobile itself has been fascinating to watch, not only on the hardware side, but on like the use and adoption. And, you know, it's very clear now. It was probably clear 15 years ago that that's where we're going to end up, at least in the near term. Talk a little bit about the kind of custom solutions you are currently, because again, there's legacy projects that are fascinating and, you know, but they're more museum pieces at this point. I mean, BlackBerry was a moment. Mm-hmm. It was a long moment. It was a significant one. And in many ways, I think, kind of teed up some of what we're doing now in terms of the business case for, you know, proliferation of mobile devices in an organization.
But even in the days of BlackBerry, it was so big that some visionaries or people well informed in the technology space didn't foresee the convergence of that let's call it a business email device and the phone that we all have today. I've been interviewed in 2004 by the Wall Street Journal by a very well known reporter, and gave him a demonstration of what we were doing on a mobile device. And he looked at me and he said, "Well, Patrick, here's my phone and here's my BlackBerry." He said, "Listen to me." He said, "People will never want to have their email on their phone. This is what that is 2004.
Meanwhile, in 2004, Zuckerberg is saying, "I think I'm going to start something that might change the nature of the game for mm-hmm. the world."
Yeah.
I mean, I remember those days as well. I was living overseas primarily, and my first mobile phone was running on GSM networks in the Middle East and Africa, and, you know, SIM cards and in and out and whatever. But, you know, just the evolution of what we can do with SMS. I mean, even now in
SMS, the US was 5 years behind.
So, and this was so frustrating. When I would come home, I'd have to borrow my mom's phone. I'm 30 years old at the time, but I'm coming home, I have friends, I want to see folks from high school, college, whatever. I'm like, "Can I borrow your phone? Because my phone works everywhere in the world except here in the United States," which is really stupid. It's a Jordanian number, but that's a different story. So even now, though, so much innovation is still being done on some of those legacy platforms. I mean, I hear stories about, money transfer networks in Somalia, for example, where there is no connectivity, but they're able to use a network of existing money lenders and brokers that people can send text messages, and then their grandmother in a village that doesn't have electricity can go and, you know, get remittances from, you know, someone who's working in Chad or in Libya or something of that nature.
Libya. M-Pesa. But,
yeah, exactly. So the eagerness to find real life uses of technology at whatever level seems to be there. When someone comes to you and they say, you know, "Patrick, we have an idea. We want to distribute our music, or we want to do any of the kinds of things you've talked about," how do you know where to steer them? I mean, you've got so much to draw from here. What kinds of solutions are currently in vogue and working, and where are you guiding? Obviously, it depends on the use case. It's a very broad question.
The first thing is the use case. Yeah. Really understand what the customer really, really need, and what they need is not, or the way they express it, sometimes you need to distillate it to be able to get to the actual need and build a requirement.
Can you give us an example or something to make this tangible?
Well, I mean, let's say at a certain level, sometimes they think they need to literally build something from scratch. And I'm not talking about having their personal cloud and so on, but
an app or something.
So one of the steps that we do is looking at what's already available. What can we build on? And yes, I will consider things such as Axway in the future, but and what already exists that might be able to serve some of their needs? Rather than start from scratch. I basically hate reinventing the wheel, and ultimately, normally, we should be able to deliver a better product at a lower cost if we can use or reuse things that have already been developed or already available, versus taking a blank sheet approach.
So it's also, when you talk to people, they don't know what they don't know. Okay, it's often hard if they're expressing a problem and how to solve it. So if you go Henry Ford, creator of the car, first automobile, if you were to talk to people about their transport problems, they would talk, I need to go from A to B and I need a faster horse, because that's what they had today. That's their frame of knowledge. That's what they knew. So if Henry Ford was talking to people on their need, he would then start working on steroids in order to create a faster horse. But you can solve the problem a different way. So the thing is, there's people have a bias to their own frame of reference. And so it's always you have to be cautious, particularly when you're looking for innovation, when you are talking to people, when they're expressing their need, because they may have a bias towards a solution. The solution is not what they actually want or what you want to create if you want to be successful in the market.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are times when you decide, yes, we need to build something. Can you give us your view on the state of the developer world? I mean, if you have a project you need to scale up a team around, how do you approach that now, given that game has changed so much? The distribution of talent is, maybe it was always there, but in any case, the ability to access distributed talent is now more than ever. Very high quality teams working all over the globe. How do you approach design and development of a new?
I'll produce requirements and submit it to some of those international teams or to some contacts, or I can build a team with people that I've worked with, mostly here stateside. But we also do interview groups from Europe, work with groups from India as well, and from Canada. Submit the requirement and see what they come back with. Also, Another key is how much control we can have over the team, over the product. We tend to keep the architecture on this side and internal, and have the team perform the actual coding, integration, and so on. So those would be the primary criteria.
Over the course of your multifaceted and very interesting career, what is one of the more interesting challenges or problems you've been able to solve? Something that kind of demonstrates, again, I'm hearing a lot of what David was speaking of in terms of the multidisciplinary, multifaceted view of what innovation and development really entails. Is there an example you can share that kind of highlights how you would solve a problem?
Probably the biggest challenge so far was when we decided to offer a mobile service to individual and small companies, is all the technical barriers that we had to overcome to take a system that was designed for the enterprise and designed for a primarily an on-premise server, and to say, well, we would like to be able to serve a company of one and to be able to. Not only a combination of coding, combination of working closely with Microsoft at the time, to get access to some internals, if you wish, to be able to make a system that was not designed to be multi-tenant, and to literally build a company on it and make something that we actually patented, which the fact of being able to, from a mobile device, starting from scratch, to be able to order a service. And this is, by the way, before the iPhone, before, so in 2004, we allow somebody with a Microsoft Windows mobile device to be able to order a service, have an account created on the other side, enter their payment information and so and such, and having the account created and have their all their information, contact, calendar, email synchronized back to their phone. We built that with a system that was not designed for it, against all odds, because people were saying, no, this is not the way you provision the system. You take the phone, you connect it to a computer, then you deliver it to the user. We were looking at it the other way around, saying we want an individual or a small company to be able to do it themselves. And so we developed all that. And that was quite a challenge. And we got the IP rights for it.
Fabulous example. When it comes to the world of SMEs, their requirements are so different than enterprise, but they're still significant. So much of the business has shifted to technology, whether it's account management, payment processing, CRMs, delivery, logistics, supply chain, inventory management. I mean, literally every piece of a business operation now has some or many different solutions available. It almost seems to me in a way that the challenge is even greater, because for the most part, these are smaller businesses that are not as technologically informed. David made the really valid point earlier, people don't know what they don't know. So how much does educating your potential clients play a role in helping them even realize that there's solutions that could be developed that they didn't realize they needed, and then they can't live without?
A lot. And a lot of it is done on the front end. I want to share something that David mentioned before. One thing that they do share is the fear. That fear is universal. An example and the concern about security. So even as we started, the requirement for this music application I was talking about. So a lot of it had to do with the context of music booking, made available availability of recording music and videos online, digital rights, and so on. So that was tied to their industry. But one thing that they already were concerned was security. So can we have two-factor authentication on the system? So even though they had no notion of what that entails.
And did they ask the question?
Oh, yeah.
Two-factor authentication? Oh, yeah. Do they say, can I send me a text message so I get
In non-technical terms.
Okay.
Yes, you're right. But they
but that do you see the same thing in what enterprise is, that because technology is pervasive, it's everywhere, is that so... within the enterprise, people want to have that consumer experience.
Right.
So there's already...
Exactly.
It works both
ways. There's an expectation set because of, oh, I'm familiar about doing it this way. I want your software to work the same way. So there's a knowledge there within everyone because they're using technology on a daily basis.
I mean, one of the most interesting periods was that crossover in market share between BlackBerry before its decline and eventual demise, and the iPhone. Mm-hmm. When people had one experience, as a human being, they had one experience outside of work, and then they had to use this other thing in their job. All the way up to, there was a conversation with when President Obama was the first president to have an iPhone. And of course, it was a highly modified one, and it didn't have a camera, and it didn't, all these other things. But in any case, people want that consumer experience even inside the enterprise. But we derailed you. You were speaking about something important here. Go ahead.
No, I was on with that point, but yeah. You're definitely right about that. And it happens in all sorts of technology, such as, but I mentioned Exchange before, but look at technologies or services like Dropbox, for example. Comes out, people adopt it. Why? Because it's so easy, it's seamless. There's no, you just install it and it works. You don't need to run a synchronization program, decide the frequency in enterprise, it was a complex process. They made it simple, and so simple, in fact, that all of a sudden, everybody starts using Dropbox, putting company information up in the cloud, which was an early term at the time, and the companies had to adapt. So some decided, well, we just block it, and others saying, well, maybe we should ask or either develop a solution that is meets company requirement or security requirement of an enterprise. And eventually, while a company like the Dropbox and others came out
and with the capability,
capability. And
it's fascinating to watch that cross pollination between consumer world and enterprise world. I hadn't thought of this, David, before you mentioned it, but of course, there becomes a pull for it when people are able to have one experience outside the scope of their work. And well, why can't we do this? Oh, mm-hmm. Well, we can't because we have to do it this way, security and things. Yeah. Like that. Well, I don't believe it. Are you telling me that when I'm putting my pictures of my kids is any less secure? Maybe it's better, actually.
Mm-hmm. Payments is another example.
A great example.
I remember in 2012, we were setting up a payment system for a small company for the Olympics. And it was an incredible challenge. Whereas fast forward today, and thanks to Stripe and others, it's just a couple of lines of code. And they simplified the process, managed to make the whole complexity completely hidden
from you. Yeah.
Yeah. And
That invisibility.
Behind an API.
Right.
Yeah.
But that it's invisible when it's working, which is at some level, or transparent in any case, mm-hmm. when it's working. By way of wrapping up this conversation, Patrick, why don't you give us your view of kind of the short-term future? What are you inspired by? What is exciting to you? What's coming at us that has you particularly interested and excited about the future?
What I think, interests me and excite me, but also I have a bit of a fear, is everything around privacy. Because I think, and David touched on that earlier, I think that that people are just now starting to see how much of their information is out there, how much can be, even though they always say, oh, we gather some information that is not attached to your, no personal information is attached to your profile. But the reality is that if you have enough of it, you can determine that I'm the person that bought an egg that and registered and uses Hulu and also drives an Audi and we know the general vicinity where I live, and you can pinpoint where that person is. I think that if there's an area where we have yet to see technology development really happen is in the protection of that privacy, or bringing back the controls to the individual. I know this is something important for me. I look at my kids, and it's they went from, oh, it's okay, we don't, you know, they use Snapchat and what have you. Then when you show them how it's easy to access their information, all of a sudden they start to realize, hey, wait a second, I'm not sure that's what I wanted in the first place. And I don't have the magic wand, but I think there's a lot to develop. There's a lot to make available in that particular field. So just bring the controls. If people want to do it, want to have their information out there and being available for free, make sure that they know that that's what they're doing. And on the reverse side, if people like me wants to have more control over it and yet have access to certain services, I can have maybe the option to pay for it rather than provide my information.
David, what about you? Again, within your role at Axway or in the broader world, what trends do you see coming at us? What's interesting or exciting that kind of has you interested in?
Ironically, it's not a technology challenge I see. It's actually a huge cultural challenge.
Yes.
And that's a culture within digital transformation. Well, that's, you know, changing the way people think, making people more data driven, making people think that, you know, how the business operates today could be different in the future. If you're talking within like R&D, it's the adoption of DevOps, the cloud, always on. So it's that more of a much more cultural change in order to draw, which will in turn drive technologies. And then you see, like, if you're more data driven, then you say, oh, we'll adopt more machine learning, we'll get more analysis going there. So it's, to me, it's the cultural change that needs to happen.
Yeah, and that's hard.
That's hard.
That's the tough stuff. And every executive or senior leader that I speak to, at some level, that's the primary concern, both internally in terms of making this work for our organization, but also in the world. It's that human technology interface, you know, because the truth of the matter is this enables as much good as it does bad. And mm-hmm. we have to choose and we have to navigate and decide, are we going to use the location-based data for good or for evil? You know, there was a time when one of these rather well-known tech companies had Don't Be Evil as its slogan. Mm-hmm. And now there's some question at some level, at least in certain circles, about that.
Don't be too evil.
Don't be too evil, just evil enough, right? But in any case, it's certainly something that is on everyone's mind. David McKenna, SVP for R&D at Axway. Patrick Gilbert, founder and chief innovator at Compendia. Thank you both for joining us for this conversation today.
Thank you.
Thank
you. For all of us here at Business Radio X, this is Dr. Adrian McIntyre. We'll see you next time on Tech of the Town.